Cuomo News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
Wednesday. Welcome to Wednesday. Welcome to Newsline PM on this Wednesday afternoon, the 20th day of the sixth month, 2012. Newsline PM, where sarcasm is just one of the many services we offer here. I appreciate you joining me. So Chris Hansen yesterday sitting down before the King County Council trying to make his pitch, trying to sell the idea to the people who are going to help make the decisions, $490 million arena, most of which I think our portion is somewhere in the area of 25-30% something, which is not, you know, that's not all that bad. And that's going to be bonds that will be paid off by arena revenue. So, yeah, you know, everybody keeps focusing on what is the risk to taxpayers? What is the risk to the county? Everything comes with some risk. But I got to tell you, in terms of arena deals and these complexes for professional sports teams, I think we're getting a damn good deal. I was talking with John a moment ago. The Kingdome was 100%. That was 100% financed by public money. There was no private money that went into that at all. And I know we paid roughly 70%, 75% for both Safeco Field and for CenturyLink Field, for the football field there. And look at that, hasn't turned out too badly. So, but this continues to go on. One of the people who piped up yesterday was King County Council member Pete von Reichbauer, who said, and I'm looking at his quote here. He said, because it was suggested that Initiative 91, which was passed about 6-7 years ago, which really spells out that the city has to make a return on investments if a new sports facility erupts on the scene. And what von Reichbauer said was, yeah, Seattle voted on that. King County didn't vote. My taxpayers in Federal Way, in Auburn, and in SeaTac would like a say. And I talked to him earlier, and I said, you know, your taxpayers in Auburn, SeaTac, and Federal Way have a say. It's you.
Well, just then that same principle applies to the city of Seattle, where their city council members had a say. No, they took it out to the public because it's the public taxpayer dollars. It's not the city council dollars or the county council dollars.
So you want to put this, I mean, have you read the entire package? Even I haven't done that, by the way. The whole proposal.
Well, if you ever need to go to sleep.
I totally agree. So what do you think would be served by putting this out to a public vote, seriously?
One, an education about what the issues are. This is not an issue about whether or not you want the NBA teams to come back here, because everybody's hand would come up for that one. There shouldn't be a vote on whether Chris Hansen's a good guy. He clearly is a good guy, and he's also a prototype of a potentially great owner. This is a financial agreement between two partners, one public, one private. One's asking for $200 million. And just as I go to a bank to get a loan, I ask questions. You know, when I take out a mortgage, I want to know all the financial questions. And I want to make sure I don't just trust the bank telling me, just sign here.
Well, let me ask you a question. I to this day, I continue to get email from people, particularly with the discussion around the new basketball arena proposal, from people who say, look, I said no to Safeco Field. I voted no on having a baseball field. And that's not what people voted on. What they voted on was the funding mechanism for Safeway or for Safeco Field. They voted on the 0.5% added to the sales tax. That's what they said no to. But in the people's minds, they were voting no on a baseball stadium. What would be different with a basketball arena?
Well, today we're going to be asking the voters to consider voting on this issue, just like we would ask the voters to vote on the seawall or the library system or the park system. These are all separate levy votes. And why are those issues, the library, the seawall, the parks and recreation bonds, why are they any less important than an arena?
Because those are levy issues, Pete, and we're not talking about a levy here. We're talking about public financing. I mean, there's a lot of financial decisions that are made that taxpayers don't have a direct say in. That's why we elect people to the county council. That's why we elect people to the city council, to make decisions of that nature.
Well, those of us who get reelected remember that we're elected by the people, and it's their tax dollars that we're representing. And if there's a major issue, like a seawall in Seattle or a park system that affects King County, we should ask the voters to participate in that process because it's their tax dollars, not Pete Von Reitbar's tax dollars, that pay for this.
See, and I don't know if I agree with that, because it seems to me that's what we elect people to do. We elect Pete Von Reitbar to represent what he believes to be our best in our best interest. I disagree with the 911 levy, for example. That should come out of general funds. We shouldn't be voting on that. We shouldn't be voting on school levies. We shouldn't leave things that are of intrinsic value and necessity to the society, to society, at the whims of a voter.
Well, going back to ancient Athens, when people came in a circle and voted in an open way, things have not changed. You know, today we vote electronically, and I believe quite sincerely that what they did in ancient Athens is applicable today. It's the citizens' money. The citizens as a group should vote on major issues such as this. The minor issues I can understand, and that's what we do. I've taken the heat in the past, as you well know, on the previous two stadiums, because I strongly advocated certain reforms. I'm willing to take the heat on any issue, but I also want my constituents who did not have a chance to vote on I-91, which the city of Seattle did, to have a chance to vote on this issue.
You know, I don't remember. Was there a public vote on the Kingdome, or was that a decision? Because that was 100% financed by the taxpayer. And I don't recall if there was a public vote on that.
You know, it precedes me. All I know is that I looked down in San Francisco today where they have a new ownership of the San Francisco Warriors, and you know how much public money they're participating with? Zero. They've decided it should be a privately funded arena. I just wish, given the deep pockets that are involved now with this proposal, that there'd be a serious consideration that why not have a privately funded arena, just like the new Warrior Arena is being proposed in the San Francisco area.
So is that at the root of all this, then, that you don't believe there should be any public financing?
I just want to make sure we know what public financing is going to be engaged. Specifically, I'm most concerned about the mitigation costs. You know, we can talk about building this facility on the footprint that they've outlined, but how about the access? Who's going to pay for all the transportation changes that need to be affected on Lander Street, on the I-90 connection? Who's going to pay for all those? And my concern is make sure we do our due diligence and know exactly what we're getting into. I don't want to jump into the pool and find it's deeper than I thought it was. I want to know exactly how much money is engaged in this process. You know, Kevin Costner can do a movie and say, you know, if they build it, they will come. They can't come if the streets are clogged. We can build the most beautiful arena in the world, but right now the streets are clogged in the Soto area with the Mariners and the Seahawks. Can you imagine a third arena there?
Yeah, the streets aren't clogged because of the Mariners and the Seahawks. The streets are clogged because not enough attention has been paid to what needs to be done down there. And I think that's something that the port has neglected to bring up, and it's obviously something that Pete Von Reitbauer neglected to bring up. And it's something I asked him more about, which we'll hear in just a moment.
Seattle's waking up to the Como Morning News 5 to 9. Right now, Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
You know what I would like to see that I haven't seen yet? I'd like to see the Port of Seattle's master plan for this expansion. I'd like to see what they are looking at in terms of relieving the traffic congestion and the street problems that exist in the vicinity where they're looking at expanding port facilities. Because that would have been done prior to the arena proposal. What I'd like to look at is what the King County folks have looked at in terms of or put on the table for how do we fix the congestion problems in that vicinity down there. What I'd like to look at is what the city has suggested that needs to be done down there. To saddle this whole traffic mitigation issue on the back of Chris Hansen is just unfair, which is something that I brought up with Pete Von Reitbauer in that earlier conversation.
Well, first of all, I have heard a lot of talk, but I have not seen specifics. Secondly, the port is talking about jobs and creating an environment in the port to move transportation. People have got to take a bigger 30,000-square-foot level look at this thing. Look what's going on in Panama. In 2014, maybe 2015, the Panama Canal is going to be enlarged. Container ships that are going to be able to take four times the amount of containers through the canal than they currently can. What's going to happen to the cargo that used to come into Seattle, come into West Coast ports, and then be transported to the East Coast? They're going to go through the canal and up the East Coast. That's going to take a lot of business away from us. What's happening now? Right now, a number of shipping companies are looking at the Port of Seattle and looking at this proposed arena and are moving to Tacoma because they're worried about traffic and the delay of shipping. It's all about getting the products to and from. And right now, products are being hampered by the existing traffic in that area. You know, and I know, and it was well written by Art Thiel about what happened 10 years ago when the city of Seattle promised the Seahawks and the Mariners that Lander Street overpass would be done and all these other changes would be done, and that money was eventually shifted to Mercer Street. And I'm telling you, there's been a lot of promises, but very few kept.
And those promises were not made based on the fact or the anticipation that a basketball arena would also be included in the Soto District. Let me open up the phone lines here. 206-421-1000 is the local line. The toll-free number for you is 877-397-COMO. That's 877-397-5666. And I'll ask a real simple question. Do you think that this requires, that the arena proposal requires a public vote? Because I'll tell you, I don't think it does. I think it further complicates the issue, and I don't think that this is what we elect people to the council for. They're there to represent our interests in the manner in which they see best. We don't, we pay gas taxes. We don't get to vote on which road improvements are put into play. We don't vote on the minutiae of government. That's why we have legislators and county and city council members and mayors and governors and such. 206-421-1000, 877-397-COMO. Should this be a public vote? Grant in Bellevue, you're up on Newsline PM.
Okay, and here's the thing. Yes, it should. But we got to look at one thing about this. When the government was formed, there were checks and balances put in there to prevent the government from running a raid. And when you get into large spending of money, the public vote is one of those checks and balances. And it is needed. We take a look at the Mariners Stadium, the Quest Stadium, or whatever they call it now.
CenturyLink.
If they were so great for the state, that would mean that it was really great for Seattle, because that's who's getting all of the money.
No, because they're
generated through jobs and all that in Seattle. So why doesn't Seattle pay for it that way?
Come on, Grant. Grant, I think you're looking at this in a very narrow manner. I really do. First of all, there are you can't look at jobs created in Seattle and say, why can't we have jobs like that in Pasco? You can't look at jobs in Bellingham and say, why can't we have jobs like that in Tacoma? We put things together. I think that the issue here, if you can look at Safeco Field and look at CenturyLink now and say that those two fields were a mistake to build, boy, that's way beyond the pale as far as I'm concerned. I think the Mariner Field and the football field, flaming successes. Brian in Seattle, you're up. Vote or no?
Absolutely, it needs to go to public vote.
Why?
Politicians are so crooked already that they just sweep crap under the carpet and do whatever they want.
Well,
if you remember correctly,
Brian,
we voted down Safeco.
No, we didn't. You know what? We did not vote down Safeco. What we did was vote down the first funding mechanism that was put on the ballot. It was how do we pay for Safeco Field that we voted on, not whether we should build Safeco Field. And if those politicians are so crooked, why do you keep voting for them?
Reporting the news, understanding the news. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
The clamoring for a public vote here, and I think it could easily gain a foothold. But I find it to be so unnecessary. It's interesting what voters want to get their fingers into. You know, when it comes to things like sports stadiums, perhaps there's more intrigue involved with the process. Because I don't think it's the money. I think guaranteeing $200 million in bonds is an extremely low risk. I think that what Chris Hansen has put on the table minimizes the risk to the people of King County. And I know there's some emotional appeal there. And I think politicians are looking, with all due props to Pete von Reichbauer, looking to dodge a bullet in case things go south. And so that's when you mention the, let's put it to a public vote. You know, we vote on levies. We vote on the seawall levy because that's going to go onto our property taxes. That's different than what we're talking about here. In a moment, we're going to talk with the father of the guy who killed those people at Cafe Racer. And what he's saying is really, wait till you hear what he says. It's surprising, and I think it'll capture your attention.
Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
Well, you know, the pain and the grief that follows all those who were killed at the Cafe Racer last month. Ian Stewicki, you know, opening fire inside the cafe there, going downtown, and executing basically a woman on the sidewalk of downtown Seattle. And ever since that day, his dad, Ian Stewicki's father, has been somewhat outspoken in respect to what could have, should have been done. And I don't think he is looking to absolve himself of responsibility, but I think he's at a point now where he's looking deeper into the system. And the issue of mental health care, I mean, I think this is a long-standing issue in our community that we've neglected to acknowledge and have pretty much ignored over, you know, many, many years. When we started booting people out of Western State Hospital with the idea of setting up neighborhood mental health clinics, that was all well and good. The problem is we never followed through with the neighborhood mental health clinics. And now we have Walter Stewicki saying, look, I was watching my son, you know, morph into this person who had some really significant mental issues and felt, you know, powerless to really do anything about it. Walter Stewicki joins me here on Newsline PM this afternoon. Thanks for being here, Walt.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So let me, because I got some hard questions to ask you.
Me too.
What did you, for example, did you ever feel, or did any member of your family feel personally threatened by your son?
Well, he did get in a fight with my my youngest, and my wife tried to get into it, and that was one of those failed opportunities over in another county. I wasn't involved in any of that happening. He had a situation here with a girlfriend, and it was one of those things where she backed out, and it was like, oh, my God, you know. I wish it had gone through. But
well, you say...
I never felt threatened by him. I'm larger than him. I can be more intimidating by him. He never started to threaten me, ever.
Well, then why did you feel he threatened others? What was it about his behavior?
He was confrontational intellectually with people. We were afraid not so much of him harming others, but being harmed. We were afraid that he would be a knock on the door, a body found under the bridge. Could you identify him as your son? We were afraid that he would be at Harborview. He got in a fight because he insulted somebody who had an ignorant opinion. That's the sort of things that we saw coming along. But we knew his mind wasn't right. We knew he did not judge other people right. We knew he did not have a lot of the breaks that people have, and we knew that his memory and his past and his identity were disintegrating.
Okay, so let me ask you then, as you've observed then, if you see him disintegrating before your eyes, as you've said, and, mm-hmm. and you believe that he suffered from some sort of mental illness, you mm-hmm. knew he had guns that he owned and kept mm-hmm. Around wherever he was. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time that you tried to get the system involved with your son in order to address the problems that he was manifesting?
Part of what I kick myself for is not pushing against it, even though I had this intellectual, you know, it's not going to work. We know where it's at. I think many of us share our helplessness with others who have nothing but their own frustrations to deal with and share with us, and it kind of puts us all down in a deep pit. Some people talk about a post-traumatic stress syndrome for us. It's a continuing stress syndrome for us.
I guess
in that we lose the perspective that other people would have. We're so locked into the fear and the depression that goes along with it that we're not as creative as we might be. We're not as willing to get hurt again by pushing against the system as we might be. Let me continue here. There's a Kendra Law Improvement Act back east, and one of the things in it, it would require mental health directors to accept reports of dangerously ill individuals, even when those reports come from family members. You see, the idea is that the family member might have some other personal grudge.
Well, but let me hold on, Walter. Let me ask you, because the basis for involuntary commitment here in our state, you can detain someone because they're likely to do serious harm to others. You can detain someone because of their likelihood of serious harm to themselves.
Imminent danger.
No, it's likelihood. Imminent danger has passed. It's now the likelihood. I guess what I'm asking.
I understood last year it's not being practiced that way. I was unaware of this.
But did you ever go did you ever go to a mental health professional and say, I need you to come and witness what my son is doing? And if you think that he's acting irrationally and is suffering from some type of mental impairment, he can be involuntarily committed for 72 hours without a court order.
He was held at Fort down at Joint Base. They kept him overnight and kicked him out the door.
Well, here's the conundrum, Walter, because I totally...
Let me just answer this a bit. There
okay.
are different types of mental illness. There are schizophrenics who don't have clear moments. There are several types of manic depressives. My son was in and out in a flash. You couldn't have somebody on call and come over and expect it to still be there. And no, I didn't. I didn't know that was going to be, because the last time I tried to get people, it was have him come into an office.
Yeah.
Nobody explains things. Let me explain another one to you. I have a woman sitting inside here. She just talked to me. Her son's been in Harborview for 2.5 months. Now, there's a group that meets weekly at Harborview for parents to help them how to deal with their kids when they're out. She got her son in there because she knew to lie.
Well, here's
Harborview wasn't nice enough to tell her that there was a support group for her down there.
Walter,
lacks of telling us.
Look, here's the conundrum. I agree with you that the system has major gaps in terms of services that we expect would be provided for the mentally ill. I totally agree with you. And I think Ian, your son, is one of those people who fell through the cracks. But at the same time, I guess I'm having a difficult adjustment to you kind of laying responsibility for this on the system, more so than what you and your family might have been able to accomplish if you had intervened at some level. And I don't mean that to sound as harsh as it's probably coming across.
I understand. And what I'm saying is there's a difference between the outside perspective that can still see those things and the inside perspective that is so wound up in it. First of all, there's parenthood. You want to hold on to them. If something doesn't work, I was telling the head of NAMI this morning, talking about some points that I want to go through, talking this same issue with a fellow on public TV, and I said it's like trying to hold on to a 200-pound fish with an 8-ounce line. You don't want them gone forever. Our son has made breaks like this. At one time, we thought maybe it was just a geographic alcoholic type thing that was going on in his life. And then we thought, you know, he's not an alcoholic. These are not part of a geographic thing going on. This is a mental issue. So
you're on
the inside, and you want to see this person maybe the day after tomorrow again in your life. You don't want them gone.
I realize that you're not looking to discard them. And I, you know, because we've got less than a minute left here.
It's a scary place to be.
Here's what I want to say. I have a lot of empathy. I have a lot of sympathy for what you and your family have gone through. And I think if there is some absolution to come, it hopefully will take the form of activism on your part, and perhaps illustrating where the system failed and where it could have worked and where five
mm-hmm.
people who are
mm-hmm.
dead
mm-hmm.
could possibly be alive today. And that's what I want to thank you for. Walter Slewicki, who is the dad of Ian Stewicki, at least putting himself out there to try to say, look, we need to pay attention to the people who are in need of help.
What happens next happens on the Como Afternoon News today at 3. Now, Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
Well, the Jerry Sandusky trial is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Then there will be closing arguments, and then the deliberations and the jury will be sequestered. And surprise, surprise, Jerry Sandusky was not called to testify in his own defense today. ABC's Aaron Katursky joins me here on Newsline PM. Hi, Aaron.
Hey there. It was a day the defense rested without, as you said, Jerry Sandusky being called to the witness stand, and it was a last-minute decision, we're told. A source familiar with the case tells us here at ABC News that Jerry Sandusky was prepared to testify, and the defense for a while thought he would need to testify, but they felt they made enough headway over the last day or so that they didn't need to take the risk.
What was the headway that they think they made?
Well, the defense is confident in its case for a couple of reasons, but specifically the testimony of a couple of police investigators who the defense suggested coached the witnesses and encouraged them to embellish their testimony, say things they weren't necessarily prepared to say, and they played an audio recording of a portion of a police interview that they conducted with one of the accusers, and the intimation was if you know they coached one, they could coach all.
My understanding was that recording continued while the witness was out of the room, and it was at that point that they were discussing some of the specifics of the allegations. Correct?
That they were discussing some of the specifics of the allegations, and the thought there is that you know that the civil attorney was trying to get information for a civil case, and again that speaks to the defense notion that these accusers were out for money.
Well, was there any real surprise in the courtroom when Jerry Sandusky did not take the stand? Because it seems to me every time he's made public statements, he seems to further implicate himself, just not only by what he says but how he says it.
He had real trouble answering some questions from Bob Costas from the New York Times in his in the public statements that we've heard. And so it may be no surprise that he didn't take the stand. It's so rare in these kinds of cases for a criminal defense attorney to allow their client on the stand. They just don't want to open them up to the possibility of a harsh interrogation from a prosecutor on cross-examination. And I think here in this case, the defense attorneys also did not want to take the risk. Too many things, they believed, could go wrong.
Now, there was also people who took the stand to try to undermine the testimony of Mike McQuarrie, was there not?
Yeah, a family friend of the McQuarries, who was among the first people that Mike McQuarrie told he saw a Jerry Sandusky and a boy in a locker room shower, and McQuarrie's the star eyewitness, and this is what the defense wrapped up their case with, trying to undercut him. The family friend testified that Mike McQuarrie described hearing sexual sounds coming from the shower, but not actually seeing a sexual act. There was no graphic description of a sex act that he saw, and this witness said that he asked repeatedly, but that McQuarrie was far too upset, far too shaken to provide that description.
One of the things that, and in fact we talked with someone here locally who's with the King County Sexual Assault Resource Center about this, two of the defense witnesses that were brought up to testify were involved with Sandusky's charity, The Second Mile. And apparently the basis of their testimony was, hey, look, we knew him really well, and there was never anything inappropriate. And it's kind of like, if he didn't molest me, why would he have molested somebody else? That's kind of a hard defense to sell, is it not?
Well, it could be when you look at it in those terms. But what I think defense attorneys are trying to get at is the pattern of behavior that prosecutors say Jerry Sandusky exhibited, from grooming boys, luring them with gifts and affection and opportunities that they wouldn't have otherwise had, then repeatedly abusing them in various places. And here the defense is saying, well, here's a couple of other kids who he would have had the same opportunity to lure and to abuse and didn't. And I think they're trying to raise doubts about the pattern of behavior that prosecutors suggested.
I've heard some of the testimony that was provided by his wife Dottie. But I didn't hear any of what the prosecutor did or anything that the prosecutor did during cross-examination. How long did that last when she was on the stand yesterday?
Not long, and prosecutors were very gentle with Dottie Sandusky. A source familiar with the case was telling me that they knew, the prosecutors knew, Dottie Sandusky came across as a sympathetic figure. She had the lime green sweater set. She talked about her grandkids, talked about meeting Sandusky at a family picnic, married 45 years, helping children. She came across as sympathetic, and prosecutors didn't want to make her any more so by, you know, beating up on her. And so they wanted to get her off the stand as quickly as possible.
Well, it'll all wrap up tomorrow, and then the deliberations will begin. ABC's Aaron Katursky, thank you. Appreciate it.
You got it.
All right, good talking with you. Something in the back. Dottie Sandusky, I'm sorry, I don't believe her. I absolutely just do not believe her. In a moment, what should fly atop the Space Needle?
You've heard what's happening. Now, find out what it means to you. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
Remember Joe the Plumber? Popped up during the last presidential election. Best friends with John McCain. He's running for Congress out of Ohio, and he's put this campaign ad together. Has him loading a shotgun and blowing fruits and vegetables off a fence, right? And then he starts this lyrical kind of historical footage note where he talks about from 1915 to 1917, Turkey established gun controls, and 1.5 million Armenians were exterminated. Then he says in Germany, 1939. Established gun control, and then blames that for the extermination of 6 million Jews and 7 million others. And then when asked about this, one of his campaign managers says, hey, it was gun control that led to slavery in the South because blacks weren't allowed to own guns. Man, am I glad this guy is not running for Congress here in Washington State. Talk about going off the deep end. Space Needle did it in 2010. They did it again last year after some arm twisting and some charitable foundation raising money. But what about this year?